Talk Legal.
It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And good morning to Wes Collins and to Cecil Harvell.
Good morning, Lockwood.
Morning, Lockwood.
And my question for the day is, what's on tap? We've been talking a lot of estate matters here recently.
Well, we have, Lockwood. We're going to shift gears a little bit today. We're going to talk about homeowner associations.
Mm-hmm.
there are just so many of our friends and neighbors and folks in our community that are part of a, quote, planned community or a homeowners association. And, of course, like so many things, these come in every shape and size. Some of them, of course, are extraordinarily developed, such as, just to pick one out, you know, some things like Fairfield Harbor, you know, you know, Beacons Reach, all of those are extremely organized, well documented. And others can be, you know, kind of historically they evolved in some way. There just happened to be some declarations out there around, you know, five or six lots in a neighborhood. But let's start with the basics here, Lockwood, which is that a homeowners association begins with the, usually begins with the incorporation of an association. This is a nonprofit corporation in the state of North Carolina that is charged with governing the use and the value, protecting the value, if you will, of the lots and the landowners in the association. And then, of course, this corporation, like all corporations, hopefully has, and most do, a set of bylaws. And the bylaws are the roadmap for the corporation, kind of dictating exactly how the corporation is to act, when they are to meet, how many boards of directors they might have, things of this nature, what a quorum might be, where a venue might rest for their meetings, things of that nature. The other aspect, though, that gets mixed in with these bylaws is the restrictive covenants.
Right.
And so the question always evolves in the office for us to interpret the interplay, if you will, between the restrictive covenants and maybe the bylaws. And sometimes they can be not as consistent as we wish. So we kind of move on from there. This is an extensive topic, and we probably won't get through all of it today. Wes, of course, will also talk about the act that governs these.
The Planned Community Act,
which governs these in many cases.
Okay, now, what is that called?
It's the Planned Community Act. It's under North Carolina General Statute 47F, and basically it's a set of statutes that were put in place. I don't have them here with me, but I think about 15 years ago, somewhere in that range. And the idea of the General Assembly with regard to putting those in place was that I believe the General Assembly noticed some problems with some of the homeowners associations, subdivisions that had been set up, you know, maybe in the 50s, got into the 60s and 70s. You know, that's kind of, I think, when the boom of homeowners associations started, 60s, 70s, in that range. When you look at, you know, the governing documents with regard to a lot of the homeowners associations in this area, you'll see that the covenants, the original documents, date back in that range.
Right.
Some flow over into the 80s. So there was somewhat of a learning curve there with regard to this new type of development that was being put in place. So, and there were some inherent problems, issues with regard to how certain documents are being enforced, uniformity, and basically I think the General Assembly recognized that it was important to have somewhat of a stopgap measure to fill in the gaps where maybe the covenants that were prepared weren't as comprehensive as they needed to be. So therefore the Planned Community Act got put in place, and it applies to most homeowners associations. So it's very important, and we deal with that on a very frequent basis.
One of the things that I'm always fascinated about with homeowners associations is the fact that at times it can conflict with building codes and restrictions of a community, a town,
right,
a municipality, maybe even broader areas, the county. And of course, there's this famous story in Raleigh where an individual was building a house, and it wasn't quite in keeping with the visual nature of the community, and the owner was stopped at 90% completion.
Right,
and was
right.
And there was either you had to either redesign the entire house or tear it down.
Right.
And it ended up going to court over
sure.
that very issue.
Yeah.
So how, you know, I'm always fascinated, but how do homeowners associations and documentations, how do they fit with the responsibility of the municipality and the local building codes?
Well, whatever is more restrictive between the covenants and the building oh. code is going to apply.
Okay.
But then you get into the issue of, you know, whether the covenants are enforceable. You get into language with regard to whether the restrictions of the covenants are detailed mm-hmm. enough, whether they're specific enough, whether they're too arbitrary in their language. And we have a lot of case law with regard to that in North Carolina. So, you know, just because the covenants state that maybe, for example, an architectural control committee has the right to make
right.
all decisions, that doesn't mean they have the right to keep you from doing, you know, basically what you're asking to do. So I want to come back to that in just a second, but I think it's important to understand, you know, the big picture here as well. You know that these homeowners associations, they and subdivisions, they start out with just a tract of land,
mm-hmm.
and the developer comes along and sees this as an opportunity, of right. course, to develop and to do what? Make money. Okay, so what they're wanting to do is put in the roads and subdivide the lots and do all those type things. They're working with the municipality or the county at that point in time to make sure that all the regulations are met with regard to stormwater, septic issues, access, ingress, egress, these type of things. And before the first lot is sold, those covenants have to go on record, because in the event that you sell a lot or two or three or four and then put the covenants on record, then that lot one, two, three, or four would not be subject to those covenants. You can't retroactively impose a restriction on someone's property they've already purchased without their agreement. So that's just, I'm just talking about the way this normally works. So that's just homeowners association 101 and land development 101. If you're going to restrict the use of the property, then you're going to put those covenants on record with all of the bells and whistles and the restrictions and the language and all the things that, you know, you and your attorney, the developer and the attorney decide, you know, envision with regard to this subdivision or homeowners association first, and then the lots are sold, and then the lots would be subject to the language in those covenants or declarations. Same thing, it's just synonymous terms. Sometimes they're called declarations, sometimes they're called covenants, but they serve in the same way. But, you know, we sometimes get in disputes with regard to homeowners associations. I mean, as you well know, and it could be an issue such as, I think I'm entitled to build this house and the association says I'm not.
Right.
It could be, I want to put up this fence, but the homeowners association says I can't. It could be, well, the homeowners association is allowing certain things to go by, but they're picking on me for mm-hmm. some reason. And I just happen to be the guy in our office who handles that type of work, sometimes for the homeowners association in response to it, to, you know, of course, address things legally, properly, to try to keep those type issues out of court if possible. And on the other hand, sometimes I'm representing the property owner or a group of property owners who are not very happy. So, and we always go back to the documents, the bylaws, the covenants, and then we look at the issues and the covenants with regard to what the association is doing and whether it's enforceable, and then that's part and parcel with the Planned Community Act as well. We have to take that into consideration as well.
So what I'm hearing is, obviously, the covenants cannot be retroactive, and so the work in the creation of this homeowners association and the legal documentation
mm-hmm.
is a lot of detail work.
Absolutely, yep.
It's not something you take at casually.
You know, you bring up a good point there. They can't be retroactive, meaning you can't impose these upon someone who wasn't originally
right.
Imposed, that they weren't originally imposed upon. But let's say that we have you know, development of the association and there's a need. Let's say that there was no restriction on trailers to be parked, but there's trailers everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and the people aren't happy about it.
Right.
Well, the board of directors of the homeowners association doesn't have the right to just go in and say, we're imposing a new restriction on you, no trailers. But if those covenants state they may be amended by, let's say, 60%, two-thirds, 75% of a vote, then, and if it's a big enough issue and you get that vote, then those covenants may be amended pursuant to those terms. And the amendment could be no trailers or only trailers for a week or,
right,
you know,
right,
whatever.
Right.
But, you know, because that language in the covenants with regard to amending them was always part of the covenants. So we're always subject to that. So you follow how that works.
Right.
Right.
You know, this leads me to the thought with people who are looking to move into an area. And of
right.
course, they look at real estate. They look at the cost of the real estate, the ability to resell and things like mm-hmm. that. One of the issues they need to look at is restrictive covenants.
You know,
absolutely.
Lockwood, I just can't emphasize that enough. I mean, we lawyers just, you know, we are a bit different in the way we see it, the world, I guess. But hey, I mean, if you're buying real estate, you need to, number one, understand your community, your immediate
uh-huh.
community.
Yeah, right.
And when you buy into a condominium or a, you know, a PUD, a planned urban little development,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have to understand that we're buying into a democracy at that point. And many times, you know, majority rules.
Yeah.
And you don't own the property without these restrictions and guidelines and covenants and can do this, can't do that. I mean, we've had clients who, you know, have been in certain properties and, you know, have a 8-9-year-old boy and they can't put up a basketball goal outside, you know, that kind of thing. Someone who just is very active with a little boat, you know, a little small boat,
right.
you know, 10, 12, 14 foot kind of skiff on a trailer and can't keep the trailer in their yard under any circumstances. I mean, then of course you move to your big condominium developments, you know, your large high rises or whatever
right.
they are. And of course, again, you're on different floors and all of that, but you are very much governed by democracy at that point.
You're listening to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. We're talking about homeowners associations, and the comment I'm making as we go to this break, Cecil, is that, gee, you've found the house, you're excited. The first thing you better check on,
yes.
what are the homeowners? That's interesting. HOA, homeowners association. Stay with us. You're listening to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, the right advice at the right time. Very quickly, to remind you, if you'd like to get more information, and by the phone lines are open if you want to call in, you're welcome to do so, 800-818-2255, 910 area code 353-4674, and the 252 area code 247-7282. But also, I'll give you their phone number at their office, 726-9050. We're talking about what I would describe as Pandora's box, and that's homeowners associations, because it pits neighbor against neighbor.
It's sometimes seen that way.
It's a challenge.
Right. Well, when we look at someone who is potentially violating the mm-hmm. covenants, then you get into the question of, you know, what can the association do about that? Well, we look to our governing documents and we look to the Planned Community Act, make a determination as to whether we're subject to the Planned Community Act. Most associations are. And, you know, for example, if you build, let's say you build a garage in the backyard, an outbuilding of some sort, and didn't get approval when the covenant state that you were supposed to get approval, then we, you know, the association doesn't have the right to go on your property, which you own, and take your outbuilding down,
right.
okay, your garage down. But what they do have the right to do is to fine you until you come into compliance. And the way that works is that the association either itself through its board of directors or through what's called in the statute an adjudicatory panel puts you on notice of the breach, what we think you're doing that's in breach. In this scenario, that's pretty simple. You built a garage. It's not in compliance with the covenants. And you didn't get approval. Therefore, we're giving you notice that you will be fined up to $100 a day. However, you can come before us on a certain day at a certain time at a hearing and tell us why we should approve it. Okay? That's just the due process that's written into the Plain Community Act. So you have that opportunity to come forward and put on, you know, your evidence. And if it ends up being a situation where outbuildings such as this are allowed, but we just made a mistake and didn't know that we need to get approval first, then maybe the evidence you're putting on is, hey, there are other people all within the association who have these, or maybe the covenants do allow certain outbuildings, a certain square footage, certain size, and maybe it complies, but the association never got the documentation to see that. Or maybe you can head off the hearing by just putting together your nice package of information and ask for retroactive approval. It would be something that would otherwise, you know, be approved. If that doesn't work and we proceed to the hearing, then the association has to give the violator the opportunity to put on evidence, consider the evidence, and then make a determination as to whether there will be a fine imposed. Now, the cap on the fines is $100 per day. It can't go over $100 per day. And it can't start until 5 days after notice is given of the decision from the hearing. So that basically is just a short period of time after the hearing for you to come into compliance. You know, take your building down or change something on the building or those type things. But then after 5 days, then the association has the right to start fining you up to $100 per day until the violation is remedied, until it's, you know, corrected in some way. And I've seen those fines accumulate pretty high, you know, based on people just being bullheaded or stubborn about it.
What happens in a situation similar to this, before we go to the break, where someone is out of compliance,
yep,
but no one on the homeowners association board makes note of it, recognizes it, or is concerned with it until, right, 6 months, a year, or 2 years later.
Right. Well, if it's out of compliance, then the association can deal with it at any point in time. However, the statute of limitations on that would be 6 years. If it's been there for 6 years, then they can't do anything about it. But you bring up a good point. Boards change.
Right.
You might have an initial board that doesn't care, and then a subsequent board that is really a stickler for the covenants and goes around and tries to police the entire subdivision. So, yeah, they can deal with it at a later date.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins right now on Let's Talk Legal. We're talking Homeowners Association, and I would think that this is a topic that a lot of realtors are concerned with as well. And we'll find out about that in just a moment. We're talking homeowners associations, and I've got a feeling this is going to be a long-term conversation. We're going to be talking about
this for a couple of days.
More weeks,
yeah, of this,
yeah. Absolutely, with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. As we wrap it up, this whole issue of homeowners associations was starting out as a new topic for a while. This is something that, as a new owner, I need to look at very early on. I should ask when I'm looking at purchasing a piece of real estate, are there any HOAs?
Look at the restrictive covenants. If there is an HOA, look at the bylaws. Become familiar with some of the history. You know, is this a homeowners association that has been embroiled in, you know, litigation and concern? Uh-huh. You know, their accounting,
their finances.
It's nothing like buying into a homeowners association and then, you know, 6 months later getting a notice that there's a $5,000 assessment.
Right.
You know, usually these things don't just assessments. None of us like assessments on anything. And so the point is that they always are kind of evolving. in history before they finally kind of become, before they finally become real. I don't know whether what I just said was clear.
But
so in other words, if you're buying into a property, there probably is some news out there, if you will. There's some information about an upcoming assessment. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the roads like? What are the pools like? What are the tennis courts like? What are the bulkheading like? Look at all of these things, because these can be things that you're going to be responsible for as an owner.
Mm-hmm. And these are the unanticipated expenses.
Right. And look at your residential property disclosure statement, which is a document that you will receive from the seller where they fill out information regarding, do you know anything about the roof, about the foundation of the house, any potential assessments, okay? And if it's marked that, yes, we do know about that, then you need to inquire about it. If it's marked, we don't know anything about that, and you buy the property and you get hit with that $5,000, then that's fraud on behalf of the seller. That residential property disclosure statement is something that's designed to put a buyer on notice of any, you know, hidden, latent dangers they wouldn't otherwise know about. That's important to look at that.
I look forward to conversation next week, because I want to go back to this issue of transition in boards. You have one board that's very casual, very relaxed. You get a whole new set of board members, and they say, we're going to go by the letter of the law. And, you know, how do you handle, the right advice at the right time. And I say that specifically with Harvell and Collins here, with Let's Talk Legal.